Hey there, my name's Oisin Dunne and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we're going to dive into the murky world of streams, lies and deep fakes and ask the big question, can the music industry handle tech-powered forgery, copyright infringement and AI-powered fakery? So I'm delighted to be joined by a digital detective and a sonic sleuth. Welcome to the podcast, Virginie Berger, the Chief Business Development and Rights Officer for Matchtune.
Great to be here.
Awesome. And welcome to the podcast, Andrew Beatty, the co-founder of BeatDap.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
Fabulous. Okay, so listen, we're going to speak about a very large and pertinent topic. There's a great fear of AI and Gen AI in the creative industry. And then we also have champions for this new technology as well, who are saying it's the best thing since digital sliced bread. But before we get into that, let's just find out a little bit about what you do, because you both have very distinct and interesting roles in this sphere, this overlap between tech and creativity and music. So Virginie, starting with yourself, talk to us a bit about what you do at Matchtune.
So Matchtune was founded 6 years ago by Philippe Guillot, is a serial entrepreneur, and they decided actually that they wanted to create tools to detect, you know, unauthorized AI generated music, including covers, altered tracks, synthetic voice, and also the platform will allow rights holder to monitor, analyze, take actions against unauthorized reproduction across all the platforms. Really, our focus, I would say, is to protect rights holders and really to scan and identify all type of alterations. So it can be on the master side, it can be on the cover side, and you know, now it's on the AI side. So, you know, we can track either AI modification like voice cloning, but also inclusion of synthetic music within a song. Or we can also detect if a song has been AI generated from Suno, Ujio, Boomi. So it helps, you know, it can be a rights holder, it can be record labels, but also a digital platform, DSPs, really to make sure that they can track unauthorized usage, that they can also fight, they can take down, they can claim, they can monetize. And regarding AI, well, it's, you know, it's another story. So it's mostly about, well, making sure that we can detect the output, maybe monetize, license, you know, take down. But for this part, it's still, you know, under discussion.
Right. Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Okay. Thank you so much, Virginie. And Andrew, how about yourself and the folks over at BeatDap? Talk to us a little bit about what you're doing there, because it's completely fascinating.
We are the leader in fraud detection. And specifically, we look mostly for streaming manipulation. So what's happening is financial scammers, money launderers, organized crime, terrorist organizations, people that are not in the music industry are loading millions of songs onto streaming services as if they're an artist under fake artist name, fake artist labels through, you know, DIY distributors. And once those millions of tracks are up on the platform, they're then manipulating the streams and running small amounts of streams to a large amount of songs. So think, 1,000 to 10,000 streams per track, but they'll do that millions of times. And through that, they will basically suck billions of dollars out of the pro rata system. So they're stealing $2 to $3 billion a year that otherwise would have been paid to real artists, real labels, and everyone in the supply chain. So we work directly with the streaming services and the distributors. We analyze all kinds of data for them. So we get battery life, gyroscope, orientation of phone, you know, like if you were in a car, on a bike, or in a bus, or walking, what you clicked on when you played the song, everything you searched in, like we get massive of like trillions and trillions and trillions of data points. And we are now the largest database, I guess, of streamed content globally across all of our different vendors. So we see so many different things. And then we have hundreds of machine learning models to identify manipulation. So someone trying to run counts that aren't real.
Incredible. My goodness. It's like a very high tech solution for an issue that most people probably don't know exists outside of very specific areas of the music industry. So
we stumbled into it by accident.
Oh, really?
We built an audit product to begin with to answer the question, how many times does a song play? Most labels will understand this. Like they typically just get a CSV that says artist A did 100 million plays. Like no one knows the receipts behind it. Is that actually real? So we built a real-time auditing solution. And when we built that, it was the cleanest source of data, and we accidentally fell into fraud. You know, you'd see 500 users playing a song 63 times on a Sunday, and you're like, that's really weird. Like they're all, you know, in different countries doing the exact same thing. You'd see hundreds of thousands of users with the exact same play pattern, and you're like, that's also really weird. So you start kind of just casually noticing these anomalies. And then when we dug in and started building models to more detect them and then verify and prove them, that's when we realized how much fraud there was. And being the best at audit doesn't matter. If you tell someone it's 100 million streams and then have to go back to them and tell them, well, these 20 actually don't count, it's a problem. So we actually had to be the best at fraud detection or we could never do audit. And fraud just ended up being such a deep well that it became our entire business.
That really brings to life your whole origin story. I can see that scene where you're huddled over a laptop and you're seeing the same 63 streams on a Sunday in, you know, 20 different global locations. And there's that epiphany that you're actually in fraud detection. Amazing stuff. Thank you, Andrew. That's brilliant. And Virginie, I'm curious to know, why did you start doing the brilliant work that you're doing? You're also a great commentator. You're a contributor to Forbes. You write about this stuff in many places. But, you know, what attracted you to this whole area?
Oh, you know, I'm quite old, actually.
It's all relative, believe me.
You know, I've been working in the music industry for a very long time, 25 years. I've started with Microsoft, actually, you know, so in technology. So I was in charge of all music partnership with Microsoft. Then, you know, I worked for MySpace. I was same in charge of, you know, licensing, dealing with CMOs, DSPs. I've always been, you know, on the creator side and having so many experience, you know, I worked for, you know, publishers like Downtown. I was CEO of rights organization in Europe. My heart, you know, has always been, you know, on the collective management side and creator side. So it's more like when I joined MatchTunes, I've always been, you know, between technology and music, actually, you know, creation. When I joined MatchTunes, they were starting to work on our, you know, CoverNet. It's our product that is able to detect copyright infringement on DSPs. But it's a bit like Andrew, it was by accident. It's because, you know, when they launched MatchTunes, it was really to help creators with technology and with AI technology. So it was more about, like, you know, using AI for video, for instance, you know, and making sure that you can perfectly sync a song on a video. And they have a patent on the art of syncing, for instance. Or it was also, we have rights lookup. So it's a technology that allows them to see if a song is licensed or not. So it's a technology that is used by a lot of big brands and corporate to make sure that when they use a song, it's still, you know, licensed. You can see, you know, all the lawsuits lately between Sony Music and Marriott, for instance, because, you know, Marriott. So it was really what MatchTunes was doing. And by accident, because, you know, same, they were working on AI, because Philippe, the CEO of MatchTunes, has been working on AI for more than 30 years. And it's our clients who ask us, do you have a way to track, you know, unauthorized alteration of the covers, of the masters? It was before, I mean, the rise of Gen AI. And that's how they started to work on it. And it worked quite well because we started with YouTube and now we are tracking on 11 platforms. So really we are able to detect if a song has been even slightly modified. So it's really about modification of the master. So it's really, you know, like pitch, tempo, or cover, so it can be anything from live music to a piano. And so modification with AI, it's really about voice cloning most of the time. So we started with those three products and we can see, for instance, on YouTube that we detect 60% more video than YouTube can detect. Because Content ID is based on fingerprinting, which is quite, I would say, old technology, you know, created in early 2000. And at the end, when you can see, you know, what happened 2 years ago with a TikTok challenge, when actually people, you know, were asked to modify the master, the audio, by, you know, slowing down or changing the pitch or the tempo, well, it's really something that Content ID can't keep track with, actually. So that's why, you know, Record Label asks us to check about it. If I can give you, you know, some numbers, we can see on Bruno Mars, who has most of the, I mean, biggest numbers in terms of, you know, modification and voice cloning, we can track that almost every day. 100, this morning when I checked, it was 110,000. It's absolutely crazy with him. I mean, it's a lot for all artists, but, you know, in total for audio modification, yesterday in 24 hours, it was 110,000. And for deepfake, it was, I would say, less than 10,000. So it's not so much, but it's a lot. And on the other side, because we have just launched a new product, DeepMatch, that is able to detect if a song was created using Gen AI. So, you know, Suno, Audio and Boomi. And we are working on the other model, but, you know, it's step by step. It's same. We are working with platform and with distributors because they need to make sure that when they send a song to a DSP, it's not, you know, fully generated by AI. It doesn't mean that an artist can't use it, but just like, you know, we need to make sure that it was not fully generated by AI. But also record labels, you know, have agreement with their creators. Same to make sure that when the creator, you know, sends a song, it's not like fully generated by AI. And we can see that, you know, every day they have a use. Just to give you an example, we had a record label calling us like emergency call, yeah, like, you know, last month, telling us that a platform, a DSP, just took down a new release from the artist because the platform said that it was, you know, Gen AI. So they asked us, you know, to check if it was really Gen AI or not, because the artist, you know, kept saying that it was not. So we checked, it was 7 tracks. So we checked, 6 tracks was perfect, real. And the last track, there was trace of AI. So we think it was mostly like, you know, maybe a sample, like, I don't know, they use, you know, maybe a technology to enhance voice, maybe. And because for the platform, it was black or white. So they just took down, you know, the full album. But it happened by accident. And we improve the product based on what, you know, our client or the industry ask us. I feel very, very good with, you know, working with industry and creators, rights holder, you know, trying to understand and to help with, you know, finding solutions, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the time of recording, I've just been involved in a wonderful event run by the good people at FS Isaac, which is an organization of professionals in cybersecurity who basically keep money in the global financial market safe. And I'm always, you know, kind of shocked by the ingenuity and the onslaught of the kind of adversaries and the hackers on the other side. But I'm always, you know, heartened and reassured by the brilliance and collective ingenuity of the folks defending us. And it's just, I feel that we're in safe hands.
It does not surprise me whatsoever. Like, one of my favorite stories from a friend that was early at Google for fraud is that the Russian mob was making money off your loyalty points for grocery stores. Like, no one knows how many points they have at Kroger or Safeway. And so they were stealing your grocery points, aggregating them together and buying rounds of cheese, and then sending the rounds of cheese to cheese banks in Europe and making massive amounts of money off your loyalty points, storing it into cheese, and then making money off the cheese, which apparently is the oldest form of storage of wealth.
As a French, I feel offended, actually, that they use cheese.
Isn't that funny? They were like stealing and no one knows how many points they have. Like, how do you know how many? Well, no one keeps track of that. So it was like almost a perfect crime.
That is amazing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If they're going to steal cheese, they're definitely coming after your music royalties. Like, yeah. For sure.
Very good connection.
I love that anecdote, dude. That's fantastic. But this kind of opens up the broader question, which is, where do we think the music industry is in terms of this broader state of play? We've got tech-powered fraud, we've got Gen AI. Is the music industry winning, do we think?
I think for the first time ever, the majors are on the right side of this. And the reason I say that is because, at least with fraud, the major labels make up less than 1% of fraud globally. The fraud that is manipulated, the streams that are manipulated, are coming from the DIY sector and not from real musicians. Over 80% is financially motivated fraud. We're talking about literally cartels, money launderers, organized crime, terrorist organizations. They are manipulating the streams because it's this big unprotected pool of capital that they can either wash money through or steal and no one notices by stealing pennies at a time. And so because no one was paying attention, they've gotten away with it for so, so long. And it's that DIY sector. So the majors, when they finally realized that a lot of their market share was disappearing, not because independent music was taking off, but because fraudsters were hiding themselves as independent music, when they put a stop to it and they started asking every streaming service, hey, you need to have a third-party fraud detection system. Like, you need to fix this because we are victims. And if you're a major label or any rights owner that has a lot of catalog, you're losing millions of dollars, hundreds of millions, up to $1 billion. Like, you are losing a lot of money. And so for them, it obviously makes sense. Like, every artist last year made 21% more money because we exist. Whether they know it or not, across the board, we moved massive amounts of market share. The difference is, if you're a major label or you're a large catalog owner, you made in aggregate way more money than everyone else, because even though it's across the entire system, you just own more of it. They were really ahead of this. And so what I would say is, they asked everyone to do the right thing, and they started you know, pushing that on everybody. And if you're an independent artist today, you make more money because UMG was the first one through the door asking people to do this. Yes, they benefited, but you guys were all on the same side of the table. Like everyone won here because in this fight against fraud, at least from a fraud perspective, we are all losing. We're all fighting this ghost and everyone's looking at each other, but it's not us. Like I'm telling you, after seeing all the data and analyzing over 4 trillion streams this year, like it is not the music industry that's doing this. This is outside threats that are coming in and stealing everyone's money. And it's hard enough to be an artist today, much less be an artist who then gets stolen from after you've had some success. So I think they were ahead of it. And then when it came to the AI stuff, again, I know that we all grew up thinking majors are bad. Like, you know, like I was always told, like, beware. But all I've seen from every major that we've interacted with has been putting artists first, trying really diligently to make sure that people are protected. And when they make a change, it's not just a change for their catalog, it's a change for everybody. And so I think everyone wins here, whether it was AI, fraud detection, other types of technology or exploitation of these rights. They've really tried to think about the system as a whole. I applaud the majors for doing the right thing constantly and consistently.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you. That's a real kind of insider view there. I mean, do we think that there are any initiatives within the industry or around cooperation that could make the situation even better? You know, are you seeing that anything is missing that, you know, if there's folks listening from the industry, maybe they could get involved somehow?
The distributors need to get on board. The problem right now is last month we had 50 distributors, 50, that had over 50%, 50% or higher, of all of their streams were fraudulent, revenue generating streams. And these are big distributors, distributors we all know, a lot of us have probably used. These are distros that are popular. So if 50% of your revenue is coming from fraud, we have a problem. It's no wonder that the streaming service is upset that all of this content is being uploaded to them. People don't realize that the cost of the content isn't hosting it. The cost is on ingesting. 70% of their cost as a streaming service comes when they ingest that content before it's ever played. So if you're sitting there and you're now getting 200,000 tracks per day and growing delivered to you, and no one's listening to them, it's just costing you money. Like last month, we looked at one of our platforms and only 0.85% of all the tracks actually generated, I think, 92 or 93% of their revenue. So the majority of songs are not actually doing anything revenue generating. Less than 1% is driving most of the revenue. And so that's a really interesting stat and asks the begs the question, why would a DSP or a streaming service want to take on millions more tracks that are just not going to get played, especially when it costs them upfront to categorize them, put genres to them, put it in and into production? So it's a huge cost for them. And the distributors here, they're all benefiting typically from the fraud. Whether they know it or not, they're taking a percentage of the revenue that comes from those streams, or they're getting paid for those deliveries. And the fraudsters aren't just picking one or two. It's a systemic problem. If you're a fraudster, you don't want one point of failure. You're going to create a lot of different shell companies, a lot of different fake artists, and you're going to upload it through 15 or 20 different distros. And so the industry has just been so unprotected for so long that the distros now are effectively the first point that the fraudsters come in. And we now have a handful of distro partners that are working with us to try and combat fraud. We need all of them to get on board because the reality is they do not have the resources to spend tens of millions of dollars fighting this thing individually. And it's not their job to be the FBI of streaming. Like they should be worried about packaging and distributing content in the most effective and efficient way possible, not trying to catch people that might potentially be fraudsters. And so we believe that we're the company that's the sort of undifferentiated heavy lift. We've already done most of it. We have the largest database and can continue to provide the best services, but we need the distros to get on board because, like last month, for example, we took 60% of content down from one distro for one of our platforms. So it is like a massive problem, and people need to get their head out of the sand and start collaborating on how to solve it.
Yeah, it's a bit more fragmented because actually we work with, everyone. You know, we work with rights organization because, as you know, collective management of rights, they have exclusive mandate for, you know, negotiating and tracking copyright infringement. So we also work with rights holder, we work with publisher, we work with record labels on the master side. We also work with distributors, DSPs that are also interested, but, you know, DSPs most of the time because now, you know, there's no global regulations about AI and there won't be any global regulations about AI. So it's also, you know, discussion that we have with them, but mostly we work with, I would say, majors, publishers, rights organization. And the thing is that there's no collaboration, but I would say it's not quite new for us because, you know, it has been the same thing for, you know, many, many years. Our first client actually was a big major. Thanks to them, actually, they really help us, you know, to define the product and improve the product. But now, you know, when we talk with our different clients and different white soldiers on the market, I wouldn't say that there's no collaboration, but actually they all have different, I would say, objectives. So when they use, you know, our tool for tracking copyright infringement on the master side or on covers, it's very, very different from AI. For some record labels, they just want to take down. For some record labels, they want to monetize. Some, I would say, rights organization is using us to build maybe a licensing framework that will fit with collective management of rights. For sure, we can talk about collaboration, you know, on copyright infringement and AI, but it's something that won't be very easy to implement because it's really, really different actors. So it's really how to create a unified framework. It's really, you know, all the discussion that we have now. There are also so many different legislations. So when you look at what's happening in Europe, rest of the world with the US, you know, the lawsuit against Suno and Udio, fair use, when in Europe there's no fair use, it's reproduction rights. It's difficult actually, so we have to adapt to each client. Like you said, I work also a lot for Forbes and because, well, you know me, and that I really want to support. But also, it's also lobbying activities because we also need to be very, very strong and visible. Because the thing that I will say not against record labels, because they are doing a very, very good job actually on the side, but maybe against, I would say, more the publishing side, is that they are not visible enough, I would say, and strong enough. So, you know, that's why we also try to support and push, because we have to fight. I can't say on our end that we can talk about industry initiative or cooperation because we work with so many rights holders involved in so many different rights. You can't, you know, you know the battle between distributors. And for sure, I agree with Andrew about distributors. They should be on board with everything, actually, and they are not. It's something that we are trying to create a cooperation, but we still have to respect, you know, our work, a rights organization, a CMO, and our work, a major record label. And it's absolutely different in terms of copyright framework. And we deal with copyright, so we have to respect it. Yeah.
That's super interesting. You know, what you're both painting is this picture where the labels, the rights owners, they are on top of things. They're working with great organizations like your good selves, both of you, and the kind of defenses are good. But let's kind of flip this over to the other side for a moment. We had Vicky Naumann on the podcast on a previous edition, and she's just a brilliant music industry professional, you know, very experienced around copyright. And she said that sometimes what she kind of has to do is parachute into tech companies and music tech companies that have kind of assumed that they can move fast and break things and just, you know, take some music and see what happens and then try and negotiate afterwards. And the world does not work like that, of course. I mean, what do we think about where music tech companies are? Do they kind of get copyright and, you know, what they need to do? Because, you know, you mentioned they're like fair use. I mean, you know, that's a bit of a stretch, right? What's your take on that?
I was going to say, I think that's the standard philosophy for tech in general, not just with the music industry. Like, look at Uber. The goal there was, okay, governments don't want us here. We're going to come in and make everybody love this thing, and then we'll suddenly pull out. We'll pay the fines every single day until the entire user base has adopted us, and they get used to us, and they're relying on us. And then when we leave, all of a sudden, it's the government's fault, and the government has to then negotiate with us. So I think this has happened time and time again. Like, you know, this is my fifth company. So I've built and sold four other tech companies, not in the music industry. And every single time, the typical playbook is to find an enemy and make an enemy of them and to go as hard as you can against them and not play ball until you have to. Like, ask for forgiveness, don't ask for permission. And I think that that is the same thing that's happening here. And unfortunately, I bet you it could have worked. The reality is, with AI, when you look at how many people are like streaming the actual AI content, it's typically one user for one stream or pretty close to. People aren't repetitively listening to these tracks. And that might change, but as of right now, they haven't actually gotten real adoption other than it being a meme or funny or sort of ephemeral. And so what that means is that there's no real business model that's presented itself off of that yet. That is sustainable and long-term. And so from my perspective, that has been the biggest miscalculation of tech. Had there been a market that adopted it so quickly, we just aren't seeing that. But had that happened, I bet we would have figured out a way to negotiate with them faster. But they basically showed all their cards and then didn't deliver on a new economic model or any real adoption. And so I think it's put tech at the disadvantage, which is good for the music industry.
I don't really agree here, because actually we shouldn't forget that actually they built their product on stealing musical works of, you know, creators.
For sure, but who cares if they're not making money?
Who cares? I care.
Like, there's no money to be made. There's a brand and likeness damage for sure. I'm not saying that from that perspective from the artist, but what I'm saying is there's not an economic sustainable model for them to continue to do this over and over and over and over again. So it's like they built all this tech for a market that doesn't actually exist yet. And that, again, that might change. But as of right now, the market's not real. It's like vaporware.
No, it's a thing that I really don't understand is that we don't need it, actually. You know, it's really the thing that I hate when I, you know, when I hear, you know, people talking about innovation and that we should embrace innovation. Well, no, we shouldn't embrace exploitation, because it's what's happening, actually. They exploit the works of others. So it's really something that I don't agree with about, you know, using works of rights holder creators. It's really exploitation. It's not innovation. I mean, if we talk about, you know, Uber, Airbnb, when you look at the consequences of innovation on the market, it's quite bad at the end. So I would say that for music tech and, you know, regarding your question, it's always been a mess, because most of the time they don't understand rights. I mean, my apologies, because French created, you know, rights in 70. It was during the French Revolution. So it was, you know, in the 18th century. So I think the first rights, it was performing rights. It was in 1777, something like that. So that's why it's such a mess, I guess, because created by French, I mean, 300 years ago. So you can see it. I would say they don't understand, because they don't connect with the fact that it's really a musical work. It's really something that comes from, you know, the mind, the body, the heart of a creator. So they don't really understand, I would say, most of the time, the connection with music. Rights, they absolutely don't understand, you know, the difference between the US, like you said, with fair use, but there's no fair use outside of the US. Absolutely not. Outside of the US, we have what we call author rights, moral rights, economic rights. Moral rights don't exist in the US, which means that actually people are not protected, you know, for their voice and likeness when they are protected outside of the US. They also, you know, I had crazy discussion when I was, you know, CEO of Harmonia in Europe. So it was a joint venture of 8 rights organization with startup explaining me that they wanted to create a framework that will be able to collect, you know, mechanical rights, performing rights, digital rights. And when, you know, I told them, yeah, it's how it works outside of the US. It's not because the US market, I mean, the US music rights market is broken in the US. It's not free market, you know, the rates are decided by the copyright office, when actually outside of the US, it's really based on market share, with rights organization leading the discussion. And it's not, you know, what's happening in the US, but startup and US startup most of the time in music rights and music tech, they don't know what's happening outside of the US. That's why, you know, you have so many startups and DSPs that were not able to expand outside of the US, because they are not compliant with, you know, it can be, you know, directive, European directive, or just, you know, our works rights outside of the US. So yeah, I fully agree with Vicky, because really, and unfortunately, they don't, I don't know, like said Andrew, you know, they think that they will be able to disrupt and then clean the mess afterwards and negotiate. I agree with him when he said that they played, you know, all their cards. Absolutely. We know now what they want to do. The market is not here. That there's no like case study, monetization. In terms of licensing, we are working on it, but we can't have blanket licensing or fractional licensing like we have with DSPs. So yeah, there's a lack of education, absolutely, or maybe lack of, I would say, willingness to understand. But if you know the music industry, and you should study, you know, the music industry, they are not easy people. Don't fight with IAA. Don't fight against David Israelite. Don't even try. Don't fight with SACEM or PRS in Europe because you're dead. I mean, they never lose. So it's really something that they need to study. It's better, I mean, instead of fighting, why not cooperating? Why not, instead of raising the flag, we are going to disrupt everything and we'll clean the mess afterwards, why not just starting the discussion with RIAA, NMPA, SACEM, PRS, and just find a way to work together and build, you know, licensing framework together, copyright, you know, enforcement together, instead of being always like against. You know, they are easy to talk with. You can just, you know, try to cooperate instead of, you know, stealing and committing mass copyright infringement and then, you know, claiming that they did nothing.
Absolutely fascinating. So this is like a whole can of digital worms. You know, there's talk of ethical AI, but that's maybe just for the moment. Companies get acquired, they get ingested into larger tech companies, they get bought up by VC firms. So anything can happen in the future. So Andrew, I'd like to just kind of zone in as we reach the end of the podcast. What's your perspective on the biggest opportunity and the biggest threat maybe for this space that we're in right now?
I have a very specific lens, which is my bias, which is if you create 100 million AI tracks and put them onto streaming services, no financial damage has been done until they've been manipulated or streamed. Because for as far as I can tell, real users aren't really listening to that content over. Even if you look at a, let's say a song that did 100 million in streams, you're talking about, what is that, like $300,000 or something like in money? But we're talking about $2 to $3 billion being stolen from fraud. So from my perspective and my lens, the problem comes with the manipulation of streams. And what AI generated tracks actually does is as soon as the songs are mediocre to good, and they're hard to distinguish whether or not they're actually real or not real, all you've done is allow fraudsters an easier time getting content. Until now, the bottleneck has been, how do I get a bunch of songs to manipulate? I can steal those tracks from previous albums. Like we've seen people digitizing albums from like Africa and Latin America from the 70s and 80s for the first time, and then loading them with different names onto streaming services. They've never been digitally fingerprinted, and they get away with that in mass. But that's still limiting. Like you have to track real music down, buy real music, hack real platforms. You know, sometimes they hack user-generated platforms, or sometimes they go after file storage systems where they can download music en masse. But the point of it is that limiting factor was still how many songs can get a hold of. You can now generate millions of tracks with a click of a button, which makes it easier for fraudsters to do their actual fraud. And I think that is what scares me. And so my perspective on this whole thing is, let's focus on user behavior and eliminating the manipulation of streams. Because if we do that, the byproduct is they don't make money anyway. For me, that's everything that I care about. And that's what I'm mostly concerned with moving forward, is how do we stop people from manipulating streams and stealing hard-earned money from real artists?
Fantastic. Thank you, Andrew. That's great. How about yourself, Virginie? What would you say is the biggest threat and the biggest opportunity? How should we be looking into the future?
Well, we can see, you know, so many manipulation on YouTube, for instance. We can see, you know, so many songs, because as we are connected to Content ID, we can see so many songs manipulated by AI and monetized on Content ID without, I mean, the rights holder, you know, approved it or, you know, being aware of it. So it's really something that we can see. We have songs manipulated by AI that have millions of streams on YouTube and monetized by Content ID. Things that we can see, for instance, someone took 30 seconds of a real song from a very famous artist, put it on Suno, and, you know, now Suno has the possibility to extend a song. And so, you know, they created a new song based on those 30 seconds of real song. And at the end, it was like a real song, you know, mimicking exactly the voice and the style of the music, put it on YouTube, monetized. Even with our technology, it was like between yes and no if it's AI or not, because it was based, you have 30 seconds of new song, 30 seconds of real song. So it was quite strange. So first, because we don't only work on AI, so it's really the creativity of copyright infringement is absolutely crazy, you know, on the master side or on the cover side. So not only AI, but really, you know, what we can see on, you know, the master side, for instance, what they do is speech tempo, just because they keep the intro, you know, of the real song, and then they put, you know, pieces of their song, and then, you know, they change the pitch or the tempo on the master side. Well, cover, you know, it can be so many things. Regarding AI, on Spotify, for instance, we were able to find, you know, some AI song mimicking a real song, same copyright work. It's quite worrying, I would say, but what is worrying is that we have to keep up with the technology. So it's a threat because, you know, we have to adapt all the time. And also the threat for me is the fact that nothing has been regulated yet. And we won't have like a global regulation. It's absolutely, you know, it's impossible. We don't have like a king of the world, you know, that will, you know, regulate absolutely everywhere. So it's really the fact that at some point we have to find a way to understand what we want to do with, you know, regulations. So it's a threat. So what could be the safeguards? What could be licensing? What could be licensing framework? So it's I'm a bit, you know, worried by how long it takes to work on it. I think we should work on create revenues, opportunities. And the opportunity, well, it's like AI also enhance creativity, you know, help with music production. In terms of rights management, it's absolutely amazing what we can do with AI. It's much easier, you know, to take down copyright claim. It can streamline licensing. Super interesting on this side. So it's not like always a bad side of AI, but really on the copyright management side and, you know, production side, it's super interesting. We also work with a company, you know, to develop watermarking from the input to the output. So maybe, you know, to keep track of what's happening between the creation of the song to the creation of an output, if the song is used, you know, in a training data set. There are a lot of opportunities, but we really need to regulate the use of AI and at least to have a collective framework about, you know, sound alike, manipulation of copyrighted work, and know where we go, even between rights holder. Like you said, you know, you asked the question about cooperation. Where do we go and how do we work all together on it? That would be great.
Well said. Well said. Fantastic. Well, you know what? That's actually the perfect note to wrap things up on. But I do have one more question for each of you. And it is a question that we ask all of our VIP guests on Audio Talks. And that is to choose a track for our title playlist. And we'll start with yourself first, Andrew.
So my track is Hall of Fame by Young Dolph.
Outstanding track. Thank you. Thank you. That's brilliant. And Virginie, what track are you adding to the playlist?
Oh, my track is from an Irish post-punk band, Fontaines DC. And the track is Boys in the Betterland.
Oh, bonus points for Fontaines DC. Absolutely love that band.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Okay. And I'm going to be slightly on brand or on theme, if you like. And I'm going to choose an ephemeral and funny track that was generated using AI, which is King Wallonius and BBL Drizzy, which is all of these things. And it's like this brilliant pastiche of 60s Motown. And it's a kind of a roast track on Drake. It's just hilarious. So listen, that was utterly fascinating. Thank you both for joining us. And thank you to you and your colleagues for everything you do to protect this wonderful creative industry that we know and love. Merci beaucoup for joining us, Virginie Berger.
Oh, merci. Thank you.
Excellent. And thank you so much for joining us, Andrew Beatty.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. So listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you are enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot and it helps new listeners to get to know about the undercover music lovers we talk to in every episode, like Virginie and Andrew. For more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more revealing Audio Talks. See you next time.